Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us started one more time to one of the most riveting and unlistened to radio shows in America, in America. But we welcome you folks. And I guess we can say happy Thanksgiving to everybody. I hope you enjoyed everything. I feel sorry for the turkeys, but that's just something that's developed over the centuries. But anyway, we have a very interesting show tonight, and that might even relate to some of the things that you're doing today, like driving, and I'll comment on the nature of that show in just a moment. And I kind of discovered some things here about this distracted driving that I thought I knew about, but I really didn't know about. And if you kind of listen up to an expert who wrote a book about that, and this book is called A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. So I think you will really enjoy what he's talking about. But we did it again. We're signed up to do another show. By the way, all the tech people and host people, helpers on Blog Talk Radio, they're all off for Thanksgiving. Isn't that nice? So I hope nothing happens and we can handle everything ourselves. And they're very helpful if you do need help from those people. We want to thank Audrey, Mike Sorrento is here, Lucy Spears, all doing work for us. And we're thinking about Lucy wanting to come back and do some of the blonde jokes, but we'll see whether we'll have her do that in the future. She finds it. She researches for them, but let's do that. The purpose of the show is what? You know what it is by now. If you're a listener, if you're a new listener, let's shorten it, because I want you to hear a lot of this presentation tonight. We would discuss news issues, events, and developments in this difficult and sometimes a humorous practice of criminal justice. I'm not going to comment tonight at all about Ferguson. You can read the entire grand jury testimony, including all of the testimony of Officer Wilson. In that case, I will only say that so much of these demonstrators, what they do is based on ignorance in these cities all over the United States. I mean, it's awful, of course, and how many people have said it. I said I wouldn't comment, but I am. Of course, it's awful that this young man died, but he wasn't exactly a Boy Scout, working in Ferguson Missouri. So anyway, we'll wait and comment on that as some more things come in. And I'm going to read all of that testimony. I think it's 170 pages or something like that. I won't be the first to do that, but I'll do that. And we dedicate to this tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals that serve us throughout the United States and throughout the world. But I must say about here I go on Ferguson. All this talk about these cops and crime fighting and guns and all this business, you know, because you've heard it from me before. It's in my textbook on the Introduction to Criminal Justice, co-authored with Robert Bohm from Florida State University. Only one-third of all calls that police officers get in the largest cities in the United States have anything to do with crime. Don't have anything to do with crime. They are peacekeeping and service, helping people. You know, I used to put a heavyset woman back in bed about once a month in an area called Parkside Homes. I couldn't do it by myself. Two or three of us would do that. She weighed hundreds and hundreds of pounds. By the way, did you see what Officer Wilson was doing before he picked up on this call and stopped? The gentleman in the street, the gentle giant, he had been on a call to help somebody recover their breathing, a helping call, in other words. Then the next thing he sees is this circumstance that has now circulated and its impact around the world. But anyway, we'll talk about that later on, not tonight. That's the end of it, I promise. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio. You can still get your own show. Any interest group, any organization, any person can sign up, maybe not tonight with the tech people gone, but you can sign up for your own radio show broadcast worldwide and streaming audio, and it will cost absolutely nothing if you don't broadcast between like 8 and 10 o'clock or 7 and 10 o'clock, something like that, p.m. Evening time. So anyway, I pay a little bit of money for it. It's not much, but for years I didn't pay anything. So anyway, here we go. I'm thinking about switching to a midnight show. That would be good. See who shows up on that one. Okay. I told you what the topic was tonight on the show. We do have a blonde joke. Let's see if we can do this blonde joke rather quickly. And must be a good blonde joke. Here it is. Oh, yes. It's even about police work. This blonde was awarded for her parking. So she told a blonde friend that there was a note on her car when she came to her car after doing some shopping that said, parking fine. Parking is fine. So she thought she got an award for that. That's it. Okay. And by the way, we do want to play the Ohio Coalition, Ohio Gun Coalition's audio, because they would like you to stop carrying guns. I know people who just got their right to carry license in the state of Ohio renewed. And Ohio, that costs about $50, so it's not cheap. But here's the message that they want you to do. They don't want you to have any guns. So when you don't have any guns, who's left with the guns? There's two parts to that answer. Here we go.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, unfortunately, Ohio Coalition, the Ohio legislature has voted against you, and concealed carry is legal in Ohio if you meet quite a few different requirements and don't have these restrictions that keep you from getting a firearm. And keep in mind, all right, here's a green tip. I like this one. I'm thinking, I really like this green tip. Thank you very much, Lucy, for finding this one. And this one says that a guy named Igor Gittelstein, he's a graduate of Shenkar College of Engineering in Israel. He just created a model of a rocking chair that has a built-in electric generator. In other words, when someone sits in this chair and they rock back and forth, a magnet slides along a copper coil within the base of the chair. And as the magnet moves back and forth with the movements of the person rocking the chair, an electric current is generated. then that current can be stored in a large battery, or theoretically it could be used to charge an electronic device, or smart, such as a smartphone, laptop, whatever. But isn't that interesting? Shenkar College of Engineering, Igor Giedelstein. Most people who go to engineering school are pretty bright folks. it's hard to fake it there. Yeah, let's put it this way. It's easier to get through on a sociology degree than it is engineering. Oh, better be careful. Sociologists will be calling me. But anyway, I thought that was a very interesting green tip. Let's go to the news and see how quick we can get through that. I told you about all the evidence that's available now about the shooting, but here's a new one. Concerning distracted driving. Did you know that distracted driving was the 2009 word of the year, according to Webster's Dictionary? But unfortunately, this is no passing fad. Distracted driving has become a trend with deadly consequences, and I'll comment on that more. For anyone who thinks they can talk on their phone, text, apply makeup, or do any other distracting activity while driving, it's time for a crash course in reality from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and other places. It's not just them. In 2012, 3,328 people were killed and approximately 421,000 were injured in motor vehicle crashes involving a distracted driver. Can you believe that? And the National Safety Council, they've looked at this. The research is going to get tighter and more specific, but now one out of four, 25% of all crashes involve distracted drivers, and most of the time they're talking on their cell phone or texting while they're doing that. We just had a bozo near the city where I live. He stole batteries out of a camper lot, an RV lot. He stole like 16 batteries a week or so ago, and they couldn't find him. And then didn't know who he was. And then he runs a stop sign going 60 miles an hour on one of our county roads. He was texting his girlfriend, who they were having a fight over on the phone, and he was texting her with messages and blew the stop sign and crashed. And when the cops got there, they found out that they found all these batteries in his car, and he confessed to what he did. He stole all those batteries. Why would he keep them in his car? Who knows? But anyway, but to kick off April 2014, the National Distracted Driving Awareness Month, that's passed, the U.S. Department of Transportation launched its first ever national advertising campaign, You Drive, You Text, You Pay. And we're going to see a lot of action on this. California police issued more than 10,700 tickets for violations involving drivers talking or texting on cell phones. And Delaware issued more than 6,200 tickets. And plus, it's a way to make some money for the city. And you say, okay, now I can do that. This doesn't bother me. I've been doing it forever. Wait till you hear Mr. Richtel make his presentation and hear about some of the other stuff going on relative to this. Have you heard about the big boom? I mean, big boom in electronic cigarettes. California is now the big producer of these things, and I guess the patents are coming down right and left. I've seen some people with these things, but if you want to make some money, get in the electronic cigarette business here in the United States. In 2005, there were just 8 e-cigarette inventions that were published in patent, like had patents, and now they're up over 500 and growing. So make some money. You know, you could be like the guy that came up with the pillow. Have you seen his ads? He's a great story. I think he employed 5 people for about a year and only sold 80 pillows. Now he employs 500 people and zillions of pillows he's selling. I don't have one, but anyway, is technology killing you? This is a news story, very interesting, off the press. Is technology killing you? Well, let's look. One of the things that we know it's doing, here's Dr. Ken Hunsra. He's done a study. It's creating what we call the text neck syndrome. Bending your head down to look at your phone can have serious consequences for your spine, according to a new study. And he's chief of spine surgery at New York Spine Surgery and Rehabilitation Medicine Center. And he's found that increased stress on your spine can lead to early wear, tear degeneration, and possible surgeries. That's one of the results of all this tech stuff. Two is obesity. You know what that is? Used to be, if you wanted to talk to the guy upstairs or the lady upstairs in your company, you walked out, went up the stairs, went up one elevator, at least you moved. Now you send them an email, or maybe even worse than that, just a text message. And, you know, we know people are text messaging at work, right? Our parents' generation, they say, was just far more active than we are now. So this can cause breast cancer, prostate cancer, bowel cancer. You're both likely to get it, and you need to move more doing that. Sleep, this could be knocking out your sleep. Two or more hours of exposure to backlit devices. Some of these people never turn off their computer, and the thing still kind of makes light in the room. You know, when you sleep, it's supposed to be what? Cool, dark, and quiet. So that's another problem that we need to look at. You can look all this stuff up in the news, first headlines, or Google News, something like that. But depression. Not only could staring at a screen in bed stop you from sleeping, it could also trigger depression. And that's been proved now with research studies. So the idea is, do something about this. Do something about this technology. It's affecting your life. As I've told many people, turn it off and live. There is life out there. Okay, here's one about dog fighting. I'm just going to say very little about this. But remember Michael Vick, the athlete, got all caught up in that dog breeding business. He was an athlete, wasn't he? But yeah, NFL football star. Pleaded guilty in 2007 to bankrolling a dog fighting ring. Guess what? It's back, and big time. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, and this is all done undercover and in secret locations and that type of thing. But people don't have enough to bet on, so they go to these dog fights. And I guess this goes way back in history. I've not been an expert on dog fighting. Kind of interesting, but the FBI just made a raid of 15 people. 15 people. They arrested 367 dogs. And they took $500,000 in cash. Firearms and drugs were seized also in Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and Tennessee. Can you believe that? This was the second largest dog fighting bust in United States history, known as the 367 case. I'll stop commenting about that. Automation, I've already commented. I'm going to skip that news article, but it has to do with the same thing about technology. We have a lawyer here in Ohio. His name is Michael Fine, 1957. He has been hypnotizing women, both in his office and over the telephone. Can you believe that? He hypnotizes this one woman during meetings in his office where they discuss her divorce case. And he has her come up with strange memories and feelings and all that business. And then she recalls when she's all done, her clothes and her bra were out of place and her private area was wet. And it turns out that's not the only one that he's been doing this. But can you imagine this? A lawyer taking you in the office or over the telephone, hypnotizing women so he can do some sexual things with them. In fact, this news article has recording of some of that stuff when the cops actually set him up to do this. He's now been disbarred by the Lorraine Bar Association. Argues it's Ohio Supreme Court that the attorney poses a substantial threat. They argue before the Supreme Court that he poses a threat of serious harm to the public. And Fine is married. He's a court reporter and is the father of two daughters. That guy looks familiar to me. I don't know if he's a former student of years back and then he went and got a law degree or what, but I can't believe that. He's hypnotizing legal clients. Oh, scares me. This is the last news story, and it's one of the most depressing and shocking ones I've ever heard. I don't know if you saw it on the news. There's a graphic sexual education curriculum meant for the Chicago public schools for fifth and sixth graders. Can you believe this? And guess what this thing is all about? They're teaching 12-year-old people, for example, the morning after pill is not an abortion pill. They're teaching them how to use female condoms. Then they have slide presentations. I have pictures of the slides that shows the female condom can also be used for anal sex. and it shows you how to do it with slide presentations with fingers. This is for 5th and 6th grade students. I pass this around. I don't do that very often to various people. But this is the Chicago school where, 44-45% of the Chicago high school students even graduate from high school. But at least they'll know how to put on conduct. Can you believe this? I mean, and the pictures are just absolutely unbelievable. And we need to do something about this. This is originally published by the article, the group called Liberty Unyielding, published with permission. But how in the world can we do that to 5th and 6th graders? And now they're, just so you do these things right. Anyway, just makes me sick. So anyway, that's enough of the news tonight. And I think we're ready to listen to something. If you haven't heard Matt Rickle discuss his book, A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. Maggie Johnson, she's author of Distracted and a former Boston Globe. She's actually the interviewer, but we hear quite a bit from her too. But what Mike Rickle tells us, Matt tells us about, is the story of a tragic car accident due to texting. And he takes you through the impact, from impact through the court proceeding, and what actually happened. So I think you'll enjoy this. Give me a minute to get set up, and we'll listen to Matt Rickle talk about this texting and technology and driving and distraction. It's thinking. Don't run away.
Hello, I'm here today hosting Afterwards with Matt Rickle, and congratulations on your new and very powerful book, A Deadly Wandering. I think it's a story about a crash, and yet so much more. You know, it's a story, as you write about tragedy and redemption, and I'd say it's a, we could call it the canary in the coal mine case of how we're living with our technology, both in destructive and constructive ways. So I think we have a lot to talk about, and I wanted to welcome you.
Well, where was that when I needed an elevator pitch? That was great.
Well, I wanted to welcome you and also start off by asking, you know, the word deadly is in the title.
Yes.
So how deadly? What is this? Before we go into the story, how deadly is this trend? And what are we talking about historically, especially vis-a-vis drunk driving, which everyone's heard about?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I like your canary in the coal mine reference. And the reason I like it relative to the question you just asked is the canary is that if you are texting while you're driving, it will kill you. But it's really indicative of a lot of other things when it comes to distraction, sitting at the dinner table, you know, being counterproductive at work. So that's kind of the extreme example. But how deadly, specifically to your question? Drunk driving, I think now, is about 10,000 a year in the U.S. It's the biggest number that we can measure of the 30,000 to 40,000 deaths we have a year. It's come down sharply. The likes of Candace Leitner and MAD and Strong Laws have brought it down sharply. What about texting and driving? The real answer is we don't know yet. We have some very decent estimates about the amount of crashes and the amount of deaths caused by phone use by drivers. And just let me pause and say, now this has been like a, you know, 8-minute sentence, and say, shall I tell you why it's complicated?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the estimates, like from the National Safety Council, would put at about, if memory serves, about 1.5 million of 5.6 crashes, million crashes in the U.S. owing to phone use. But those are estimates. And the reason we don't know is because it's very hard to track for police agencies. It's hard to get the information. Mm-hmm. People lie. And we just started trying to collect the data. So the estimates are based largely on how much we know people are using phones and how many crashes there are. Just to give one example of how we know that the official numbers are so far off, there's a number from about 2011, which is the latest data we have, of deaths owing to phone use. And Tennessee remarks 93 cases, and the state of New York remarks one. Just simply impossible. We're not tracking it accurately. So the short answer is we don't know. The long answer is all the science and everything we see on the roadways say it's a big and growing problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about Story, because we are dealing with a very, very important problem. You know, it does seem to be on the rise, even if we're not quite sure of the ramp, you know, the scope of the problem. Tell me about the story, the accident.
Yeah.
Briefly, because it's a very gripping model or example of what could happen to all of us.
Yeah. When I thought about writing about all the science, I'm sure we'll talk about it at some point, I thought, you know, what interests me when I read anything is story. It's character, it's narrative, it's emotion, it's conflict. And I could not have invented and could not have imagined the story that I discovered in reporting this out. It starts with a young man, 19 years old, September 22, 2006, and he's driving to work at 6:30 in the morning. It happens to be the last day of summer, but already there's freezing rain and it is dark, and he is going 55 miles an hour, which is the speed limit, but he's swerving periodically across the yellow divider. And this is noticed by the guy driving behind him, who happens to be a farrier, a horseshoe maker, who's got 2 tons of horseshoes and horseshoe-making equipment, a missile at highway speed. And the last time Reggie Shaw, the young man who I mentioned earlier, swerves across the yellow divider, he clips a Saturn, carrying, again, can't make this stuff up, 2 not only fine family men, but no kidding, rocket scientists. The real thing, building boosters for the next space shuttle. He clips them. They spin across the road. They are hit by the farrier broadside, and the 2 men in the Saturn are killed instantly.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a tragedy.
Quite a tragedy.
But, of course, as we're talking about, it's an example of so much more. So let's get into, you know, what this represents, for instance. You know, one of the most amazing reasons, and I think it might have been why you came to write this book, you can tell us about that, but, you know, one of the most amazing issues related to this is why do people do this? You know, we can talk about, do they know the risk? In 2006, there were arguments to and from.
Yeah.
I guess we can assume now that many people have an inkling of the dangers. So let's start to talk about a little bit about why we do such a self-destructive thing as
texting. Right. So just to square the circle, in case it's not explicit, Reggie was texting. He denied it. He stops down the road 100 yards unscathed. He says he hydroplaned. There's a fierce law enforcement hunt, essentially a Sherlock Holmes-like meets the digital age experience, and they discover after 18 years of looking that he has texted 11 times in the minutes and seconds around the crash, maybe at the crash. You have this first-ever criminal trial, this historic precedent. But you ask the question – well, just to finally, he's texting something innocuous, like good morning to a young woman he's barely even dating, he's just getting to know. What would compel a young man who is a decidedly good person, although as you read in the book, he's got a little bit of a checkered past when it comes to telling the truth. So he's got some issues, but he's a decidedly good guy, kind of the all-American guy. What would compel someone who knows the difference from right and wrong to look down in his lap? This turns out to be a long scientific journey, and so let me try to break it down into pieces. Maybe the best way to start, Maggie, is to give you an image of us going back let's say, a million years or 100,000 years, picture a caveman or cavewoman, and that person is tending to a fire. And he or she gets a tap on the shoulder. I would just ask you, what do you think, were it you, would you be able to avoid turning around? If someone tapped on your shoulder and you were tending a fire and didn't know who it was, do you think you could ignore the tap?
No, not at all.
Okay. Obviously, I mean, leading question, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yeah, but if of course you couldn't. You don't know if it's threat. You don't know if it's opportunity. Is it food? Is it someone with a spear? That's the first image I would put in people's minds, and I'm going to get into the neuroscience of this in a minute. Essentially, when you're driving in the car and the phone rings, the first thing to think about is that is a proverbial tap on the shoulder, Maggie, and it is from anyone anywhere in the world, and you've got no idea, is that opportunity, is that threat, is that my boss, is that my spouse, is that my potential mate, you know, it's unknown, and so this technology has given us kind of like a warp speed version of the tap on the shoulder. Now, maybe I should pause here and talk before I go to the next kind of level of the lure about the neuroscience of that moment. Is that
work? Tell us a little bit about the limits to our attention, which has been, you know, well studied for, you know, more than a century. We're a very limited animal when it comes to our attentional capabilities, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what's happening in that moment, and it'll kind of go indirectly to answering that question of limits, is let's go back to the cave person. The cave person tending to the fire is using this part of the head, the prefrontal cortex. It's, they call it executive control. It's the thing that makes us most human. It's the thing responsible for art, architecture, civilization. But when the tap comes, or the roar of a lion, it sends a signal up from here, the reptile parts of the brain, much more primitive survival mechanisms. And let's say in the case of the lion, it says, boom, lion, run. And this part, the part that's doing these kind of high-level tasks, must listen to that lower part of the brain. Because if it didn't, guess what? You get eaten. So now let's go back in time to start to understand how we begin to understand these limitations of our brains. We cannot ignore, first of all, that reptile sound. I mean, if you can, you know, you would essentially have to have eyes in the back of your head. So going back to the mid-1900s, right after World War II, these scientists in Britain were really wrestling with a question. Why was it that their pilots in airplanes fighting the battle over Britain, why was it their radar operators could have trouble with these screens in cockpits, could have trouble with what they were looking at? Why was it that they couldn't focus on a life and death situation that they were getting interrupted? Part of it has to do with the civil war going inside your brain that I've just described. If something came from here, it interrupted the ability to focus, even if the focus was on, you know, something very important. But secondly, what they discovered, and it's even more basic point, was something called the cocktail party effect. And this happened right in the aftermath of World War II, these kind of initial neuroscientists whose stories I tell you in the book were gathered in Britain, and they were trying to figure out, well, how much information can we possibly handle? I mentioned the cave person image. Let me ask you to come up with just you and our audience to think of another image. You're at a cocktail party, and you're talking to the third person in front of you, as I am currently talking to you, and you try to listen to the person standing behind you. What you will discover, because I've tried this a number of times, is that you can really only do one thing. I can focus on Maggie. You deserve my attention. You're listening to me. Or I can switch my brain, in effect. I can switch the track and listen to that person. But at that point, I can no longer listen to you. It is simply physically impossible. And Maggie, we've known this since like 1948, since all these tests were done. with one tiny, tiny exception, which is I can listen to you and just maybe I can pick up my name or the change in gender behind me. So that is not new science. That goes back to, 1950. Over the years between 1950 and 2000, the neuroscientists began to refine these models. How limited is what we can do? And what they begin to discover is that there are networks of attention in our brain. They discover they can literally watch inside the brain blood flow and discover when you're attending to one thing and you shift your attention, you can see that the load shifts. You can't do both things. You can't juggle both things. Now, it is often said that there is a myth of multitasking. And again, that understanding, at least by neuroscientists, goes all the way back to 1948.
Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about, again, a creature with limited attentional capacity. You know,
yes.
We are destined to jump to what's novel and expected and unexpected in our environment. And, attention is something that, if you're paying attention to something, you're going to be blind to. If you're paying attention to, say, your cell phone call, you're literally blind. The visual signals into your
literally
cortex
blind.
When a child jumps into the street, et cetera. So add to this, let's talk a little bit about the allure of the technology. You wrote about the social connection that technology so often represents, and I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, so there's three or four levels of this. One is the social connection. And the social wiring is very, very deep in us, and it is, a survival mechanism. In fact, as we go through this conversation, I think what I'll begin to describe is that the power of these devices comes because they are, in effect, survival mechanisms that are becoming so powerful that they can be counterproductive and even deadly, so anti-survival mechanisms, for want of a better word. But on the social point, let's go back to the fire analogy. One of the values of being social is that we learn from each other. So if, Maggie, if you learn that fire burns you back millennia ago, but you're unable to communicate that to me, then I have to burn my hand in order to not get killed. Because I get burned, I get infection, I'm dead. Language itself, the telling, oral, written, anything else, is so deeply wired on a social level because it helps us survive. It tells us, go into the bomb shelter. I mean, go down the list of ways. So communication and the idea that communication could be urgent is deeply wired into us. And not just that. It's not just the receipt of information that is so powerful, but as I document in this book, the sharing of information, Harvard researchers have shown, gives you a dopamine rush, helps squirts your reward centers in your brain. It is reinforcing the idea that the sharing of social information is a reward. So now you've got the receipt being a reward, you've got the sharing being a reward. I'll just pause there and say that is one way in which our devices lure us, but it is only one of several.
Mm-hmm. And so you're painting a picture of someone behind the wheel getting extraordinary temptations
yes.
from that device beside them. It might be a computer. It's often a smartphone now. There's a person at the other end. There's something possibly rewarding, and even the idea of peeking behind the curtain of its novelty is rewarding. So
Before you go on to that, let me pause because you said a really important word. You said possibly rewarding. I think maybe in some ways my favorite bit of science that I learned in this, the one that really surprised me and honed in on just how powerful these devices are, is that you would think to yourself, well, Matt, Maggie, or, whomever, if I know that a lot of this stuff is spam, and it is, 67% of what we get is spam, at least in email, then I would get conditioned to ignore it because I know it's worthless. Going back to your word, possibly important, it turns out that the very fact that most of this stuff is worthless makes it even harder to resist the phone. This goes back to B.F. Skinner and a concept called intermittent reinforcement. And the way I would illustrate it is, it'll probably connect to your audience as it did for me, is that you've got a rat in a cage, and the rat is supposed to push a lever to get food, but the rat doesn't know which push will bring the food. So the rat is compelled to push all the time, all the time, all the time. It's called intermittent reinforcement, one of the most powerful lures in all of psychology, and it is, if you'll forgive the comparison of us to rodents, it is exactly the same thing happening with your phone. You press and press and press and press because you don't know when the good thing's going to come. As many scientists call it, it's a veritable slot machine in your pocket. So you add that piece to the social wiring, you're starting to find something super powerful, and I haven't given you the full range of the lure yet.
It's really powerful, yes.
Really?
I don't think when people are doing it, they quite realize quite what a package of dynamite is, again, sitting in the car with them. I think it also seems as though it's just such a part of our daily life. It's receded as a fixture, as a tool. So that, you know, kind of perceptual invisibility also adds to the fact that, you know, what it's doing to us, is kind of becoming invisible.
Well, I like the way you put it, is where it's just become a fixture. I mean, it's like we understand it to be part of life, and maybe even, to go a step further, a celebrated fixture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the way the advertising is today, it may not tell you to do this in the car, but it certainly celebrates being on all the time. And I sort of document the ads coming from various places that say, try to do more faster, from, say, wireless companies, or do two things at once is this, you know, ad from one company where it's little kids, and they say to the little kids, of course you'd want to do more than one thing at a time. And the kids say, well, of course I would. So it's a fixture. It's become invisible. It's become celebrated. And that is, if we're sort of enumerating, you take the social, you take the slot machine, you take the cultural, and still we're not done, but you're adding up again. You're amassing a pretty irresistible thing.
Mm-hmm. And to push that point a little further, tell us about I don't know if complicity is too strong a word, but what was news to me is, the idea that the mobile phone companies and the car companies, and you can still see this today, the car companies want more on your dashboard.
Yeah.
The mobile phone companies want you, you know, to have this device at hand at all times. So, tell us a little bit about that, because there were echoes to me of smoking.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that was a conspiracy, but that was really, really passionate, very interesting.
Well, look, there's another one of these, as I report this book, one anecdote after the next that, you know, when you're on the phone reporting, and you've experienced this where you go, you know, you've got the phone to you and you go, you got to be kidding me. And it's one of the neuroscientists in this book who played a huge role in the Reggie Shaw case that we talked about at the beginning, is named David Strayer. And he worked, as a lot of neuroscientists do, he sort of went into corporate America when he first started, and he was working for one of the cell phone companies in the early 90s, and they were starting to market these phones as car phones. And he went to them and he said, I think we've got a problem. I understand he was in this long line of people going all the way back to World War II, sort of this very kind of fine line connected all the way back to the beginning of neuroscience, where they understood this stuff we were talking about. And he went to his bosses and he said, I'm not sure you understand. This can't work. This is dangerous. And as he records the anecdote in the book, they said to him, why would we want to know that? And he said, like, to him it was self-evident, because people could be in trouble. And the way he describes the situation, knowing that would be very counter to making a lot of money. Now, I want to be really careful in this conversation, because the cell phone companies have actually gotten much more responsible, but I do think it's worth noting the point you brought up. Early on, the cell phone was the car phone. That's how it was sold. The reason it was sold that way is because that was where you didn't have phone service. So if you're trying to build a business, you're going to build it where you can't have phone access. The early cell towers, Maddie, went up on the highways. The money was made there. And you remember what they used to charge. It was like 50 cents a minute, right? And the advertising, the marketing from the cell phone companies reflected this. There would be, you know, a guy, there'd be a literally an ad with a guy talking, standing in his Jeep, you know, or sitting in his Jeep, phone to his ear, you know, speeding down the road. And it was a glorification of this. I think there was one, I'm closing my eyes because I'm trying to remember, it'll be in the book, but, you know, it said something like wildly offensive on a number of levels, but like, can your secretary take dictation at 55 miles an hour? And it's a guy in a sports car talking on the phone, right? Okay, so that's the early days. The car phone, it's hard to imagine that the wireless companies didn't know. And in fact, early on, some very courageous legislators, particularly in California and in Utah, where this story happened, early states got fought by the wireless companies, who says, let people do what they want. We're not sure of the risks. Parallels to the, you know, the smoking industry is a very weighty, probative thing, and so I don't think it's, you know, I wouldn't use that exactly, but I mean, it was the kind of prevarication that is very unnerving. Now, these days, the cell phone companies have really taken the mantle of no texting in particular. I mean, they've put out apps to block things, AT&T, Verizon, go down the list. They have campaigns, they have public service announcements, but by now it's also ensconced in our culture. The auto companies is a different – here, let me pause, full stop. Shall I keep going?
We're approaching a break,
okay.
And I think we want to talk about solutions,
yes.
And where both the industry and where we fit in. You know, I'm getting a picture, an incredible picture of, you know, individual accountability and perhaps societal responsibility here,
yes.
And where it all fits in. Just before the break, we have 5 minutes. Why don't you bring us back to the story?
Yes.
And we'll, you know, parcel this fantastic story out in increments, as
okay.
You did in the book, because
okay.
It's a real page-turner, and here is this kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think maybe vis-a-vis the, you know, what the issues that we've been talking about, there was some denial.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if we all have had about this issue. Tell me a little bit about his first reaction, just briefly,
yes.
And, you know, how the scene was set for what came to be a trial or a judicial event.
Just briefly, he pulls over to the side of the road. He tells the police he doesn't know what happened, maybe he hydroplaned, and this tenacious state trooper takes him to the hospital to get a blood test and notices that he's texting. And the trooper tells me, and it ends the first chapter, this guy's a one-hander. And he spends the next 18 months in this hot pursuit trying to get the phone records. And Reggie, apropos of what you just said, one of the big issues, he says he didn't do it. He gets a lawyer, and a standoff is set for this first ever, this historic trial. And then I'll tell you more as we parse it out.
Mm-hmm. And we do have a couple more minutes. So, you know, what happened, happened over many months, as you said. And I think, you know, doesn't this initial reaction perhaps speak to what we'll go into later, but the idea that it can't happen to us?
Yeah. I mean, it's all the things you're bringing up. I mean, I thought it very initially when we started talking, when you were talking about all the things it represents. One of the things it represents is denial. And he's a metaphor for our collective denial it can't happen to us, and the denial we do when we don't want to admit to the other driver, oh, yeah, I dinged into you because I was doing a status update. And adding to the drama in this case, Reggie had let his community down once before. He was living with a lie in his past, and he'd come clean about it, and he was feeling a sense of humiliation, and he couldn't stand the idea that in this small community in northern Utah, he might let his family down again.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing the story represents is, you know, that it could happen to any of us. I mean, you know, again, after the break, maybe we'll get, you know, return to some of the statistics on the scope of the problem, but the research I've seen shows that, particularly in younger ages, but you know, 40%, I think, in your book, people said they had read text. 30%, they had spent text.
Yeah.
Now, the statistics are astonishing. We're not talking about a minority of the population, right?
Yeah. Well, you brought up something about partly why we can deny it won't happen to us is because we have a bad control group, as they say in science. If you've done it 100 times and not gotten in a wreck, then you say to yourself, well, 100% of the time I haven't gotten in a wreck. Therefore, I won't get in a wreck. But it's a terrible control group because 101, or in Reggie's case, who knows, you know, 31, two guys are dead.
Right. And, I mean, we're dealing with a one-ton slot machine on a rainy highway, so... And we'll pause right there, and we'll be back in a minute for more talk on attention and driving and distractions with Matt Rittell.
On the Go, Afterwards is available via podcast through iTunes and XML. Visit booktv.org and click podcast on the upper left side of the page. Select which podcast you'd like to download and listen to Afterwards while you travel.
We've been talking about the Deadly Wandering, this fantastic new book you've written, and I'd like to return to the science of attention because, you know, as many scientists have told me, attention is really the human faculty. It decides, you know, where we pay attention determines our life, and this many series of decisions we make and don't make about our attention every day weaves the fabrics of our lives. And so tell me a little bit more about some of the latest multitasking research. For instance, some of the viewers may have heard of this, the fact that there are supertaskers.
Yes.
How many are there? You know, can we really juggle and, you know, maybe we don't need to be as conservative as the scientists tell us?
Yeah, the short answer is no, we can't really. I mean, I think there are anomalies everywhere. You know, there are 7'6" people who can dunk a basketball on their tippy toes. But, you know, none of us would, you know, like try to set up a stretching machine and become that in our home. What percent of supertaskers? It's tiny. I think it's less than 1% if memory serves from the book. Clearly, I am not a supertasker or I would remember that number. But I do mention in the book that there are some efforts underway to understand what are the mechanisms that allow us to build our attentional networks. And some of the neuroscientists in the book talk about the, whether we might actually use video games or other techniques to improve our visual acuity. So there's some hope of that. But may I go back to something you mentioned earlier about attention and being the sort of the building block of how we see the world. As it goes to multitasking and our limitations, you put it so beautifully a second ago, and I don't remember exactly what you just said, but it may actually not just go to what we attend to, but our choices, and even further, and it's a big concept, but even free will in a way, and I'll give you a study to back this up. And it even goes to Reggie and how much control he had in this moment. There's a study I'm going to guess some of your audience has heard of, and I'm going to get it. I'm going to oversimplify it, but it's a chocolate cake study. You remember this one? Yeah. So maybe you can help me remember exactly, but I think it goes like this. Some study subjects go in a room, and they get a choice. Would you like the chocolate cake for a snack, or would you like the fruit? And some of the study subjects are asked before going in to remember a string of numbers. And by a statistically significant margin, the ones who had to remember a number choose the chocolate cake. And the ones who didn't choose the fruit. And they factor for these, you know, brilliant neuroscientists factor in for all a bunch of causes. And what they really are coming up with is that when your brain is not even overloaded but with information, but taking into account significant information that it has to remember, it affects your decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
So now bring it back to the phone in the car. Merely sort of like thinking about what's going on with your phone, anticipating the phone, talking on the phone, you are beginning to impinge a little bit of your decision-making power. And to cover the broad spectrum, that's a potentially deadly thing in a car, but it actually can go all the way to the restaurant where you're choosing what to eat, or to how you interact with your, you know, going back to the beginning, spouse at dinner.
Mm-hmm,
I'm clearly getting a snack food element to this talk.
So even something as automatic, as habitual, as routine, as driving a car, I mean, you know, 16-year-olds are doing it because they don't have the judgment and their frontal lobes are not as involved or, you know, developed. But, you know, people our age, people of all ages are doing it in part because they're assuming that, you know, they can handle this. They can, you know, driving is so habitual that it shouldn't take those frontal lobes. Isn't that one kind of assumption?
Yeah.
You know, and you're saying that, you know, when we're tired or when we do face that situation where we need to slam on the brakes, the brain, you know, isn't able to react as quickly as we want.
Look, make no mistake. Driving deaths are an epidemic that we have not solved. I mean, this is not a situation where people are doing some overtly negligent behavior, you know, drinking themselves into a coma, you know, taking a gun into the square. This is good people driving to destinations they want to reach with good hearts, not hoping to hurt anybody, and 30 to 40,000 people a year dying. And I would bring something up here statistically. You know, there's one of the issues that for a while the wireless industry brought up, they don't anymore, was, well, driving fatalities have come down in the U.S. You know, Maggie, that is true, but two other things are also true. They've come down far less than other countries, and they've come down at a time when we have spent billions, B, on wider roads, airbags, lots of safety measures in the car. So what the public safety advocates will say is you would be seeing much better safety improvement. So to your going, you know, to bring this full circle to your point about, you know, don't take it for granted you can drive, because tens of thousands of people a year are dying. I also want to go back to something else you mentioned, the young brain. Can we touch on that for a second?
I think that's very important because the statistics.
We're going to shut it off there. There's about 20 minutes left on that, and you can go to booktv.org, booktv.org, and type in the search box the title of the book, and it'll come up. And you want to type in a deadly warning. And the remaining 20 minutes is very interesting also. You see what's happening, we're saving lives through safety and better roads and all kinds of things, but we're still killing people at a rate that's not even known accurately at this point based on this technology in our cars. Now they're saying, well, you put it in the car, you won't have to use your phone, you can talk, you know, whatever. You know, it's going to have consequences. And anyway, I hope you enjoyed that a little bit. And again, enjoy the rest of your Thanksgiving day and weekend. And we'll see you next week. And what we're going to do right now is ask Vera Lynn to sign us off singing We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know where, don't know where.